Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Ninth Circuit Jury Instruction Post-Decision Edition. Thanks for tuning in. On Tuesday, December 2nd, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Hedgepeth v. Pulido, and on Wednesday, January 21st, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Waddington v. Sorausad. In both cases, the Supreme Court considered Ninth Circuit rulings in federal habeas review cases involving jury instructions. In Hedgepeth, the Supreme Court vacated the Ninth Circuit's judgment, which had held an alternative legal theory error to be structural, and remanded the case for further proceedings. In Waddington, the Ninth Circuit had granted a writ of habeas corpus to Cesar Sorausad after finding a, quote, reasonable likelihood that the jury who convicted him had unconstitutionally misapplied their instructions, but the Supreme Court reversed this decision and remanded for further proceedings. To discuss the decision, we bring back from our post-argument podcast on these cases, Baker Hostetler partner Lee Casey. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Casey.
The Supreme Court has decided two important cases dealing with the standards applicable to federal habeas review. In Waddington versus Sorausad, it dealt with the standard of habeas review under the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. Under that statute, a federal court may grant habeas relief to a state prisoner only if the state court's decision was contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. To the extent that the state court's application of federal law is at issue, its decision must be shown to be not only erroneous, but objectively unreasonable before relief can be granted. In this case, the federal law at issue was the Supreme Court's rule, drawn particularly from Estelle v. McGuire, 1991, that a defendant challenging a jury instruction must show both that it was ambiguous and that there was a reasonable likelihood that the jury applied the instruction in a way that relieved the state of its burden of proving every element of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The crime here was accomplice liability for a drive-by gang shooting. The defendant, Cesar Sorausad, drove a car from which a fellow gang member shot into a crowd of high school students, killing one and wounding another. Sorausad claimed that he had not known that a shooting would take place, but in the event was convicted as an accomplice to second-degree murder. During his trial, the prosecutor had suggested that the Washington State standard for accomplice liability was in for a dime, in for a dollar. That is, if the accomplice agreed to assist in any criminal act, he would be an accomplice to any offense that took place, even if he believed that only a lesser offense had been planned. The Washington courts later made clear that for accomplice liability to attach in that state, the defendant had to know of the actual crime charged. In this case, however, the Washington state courts also concluded that the jury had been properly instructed on the correct standard, since the trial judge had read to the jury the relevant statutory language, which spoke of knowledge of the crime, not a crime. The United States District Court in Seattle and the Ninth Circuit disagreed, finding that there was ample evidence that the jury was confused over the required mens rea in this case, and that the state courts had applied the Estelle standard unreasonably. Emphasizing the deferential nature of habeas review under the AEDPA, the Supreme Court reversed in an opinion by Justice Thomas, joined by Justices Kennedy, Scalia, Alito, Breyer, and the Chief Justice. The court ruled that the Washington state courts had reasonably concluded that the trial court's instructions were not ambiguous, having read the statute to the jury as permitted by the Supreme Court's own precedents. Even if the instruction was ambiguous, however, the court did not believe that a federal constitutional violation resulted because the Washington courts had reasonably applied federal law in determining that there was no reasonable likelihood that the prosecutor's closing argument, emphasizing the in for a dime, in for a dollar standard, had caused the jury to apply the wrong standard, thus relieving the prosecution of its burden of proof. Justice Souter, joined by Justices Stevens and Ginsburg, dissented. The dissenters argued that the prosecutor's initial explanation of the in for a dime, in for a dollar standard had clearly suggested that an accomplice could be found guilty based on knowledge of any crime rather than the one actually committed by his principal. This, they noted, was an incorrect statement of Washington state law, and it was not properly corrected by the trial judge, the statute itself having been so ambiguous as to have required clarification by the state Supreme Court. In the end, it seems that the real disagreement among the justices was over how deferential a federal habeas review is under the AEDPA. In addition to Waddington, the court has also issued an opinion in Hedgepeth versus Pulido this term, a second case dealing with the standards for federal habeas review. That case, however, dealt with the question whether an error in jury instructions that permitted conviction on multiple theories of guilt, where one of those theories was legally flawed, was subject to harmless error analysis. All of the justices agreed, as did the parties in the end, that such an instructional error was subject to harmless error analysis, but the court split 6-3 with Justices Stevens, Souter, and Ginsburg in dissent on whether the lower federal courts had already adequately performed such an analysis, as argued by the defendant, and found that the instruction was not harmless error in this case. At issue were instructions given on the California felony murder standard. California law permits felony murder liability only where the accused formed the intent to aid and abet the underlying felony before the murder, not if that intent was formed afterwards. In this case, involving a convenience store holdup, the defendant argued that he assisted in the robbery only after the murder took place and could not, therefore, be guilty of felony murder. The trial court's instruction admittedly permitted a felony murder guilty verdict regardless of when the accused intent to aid the underlying felony was formed. The Ninth Circuit had characterized this type of instructional error as structural and therefore subject to reversal unless the court could determine with absolute certainty that the defendant was convicted on a proper theory. Because the court could not make that finding here, the conviction was reversed. The Supreme Court reversed this decision, definitively holding that instructional error of this type was not structural, requiring reversal regardless of whether the error was harmless or not, but clearly subject to the harmless error analysis articulated by the court in Brecht versus United States in 2005. That is, whether the error had a substantial and injurious effect. The case was remanded for this analysis. The dissenters accepted the defendant's argument that regardless of what the Ninth Circuit called it in terms of structural error, both the district court and that panel had actually performed a case-specific inquiry, which left both uncertain of whether the jury relied on an invalid legal theory in convicting. In effect, this applied the Brecht standard for harmless error and resulted in a correct finding of injurious error. Remanding the case was, they suggested, simply a waste of judicial resources. The majority, however, noted that the Ninth Circuit panel had only mentioned Brecht fleetingly in a footnote and that the standard it did apply, absolute certainty that error did not prejudice the defendant, was in any case incorrect.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.